everyone. And thank you so much for coming out to our Issues and Ale. We are so thrilled to see you. Yes, for election night. Finally, it's here. I'm Cynthia Canty, host of Stateside, and it's my pleasure to bring you this wonderful panel of experts to bring opinions. We are looking for your questions, so that is very much on our minds as we go through this evening. First of all, we want to thank the Circus Bar for being our kind host for tonight's event. Yay, Circus Bar! Order beer!
It's a
75-cent Pabst? I don't know. Are we dating ourselves, Miss Zoe? Also want to let you know that Alyssa is working on getting tweets up, so if you are in the mood to tweet through this evening, the hashtag, it's @issues_ale, so we would welcome that, and it'll pop up on the screen as well. Just to let you know what we're going to do, we're going to be balancing panel discussions with some watching. So as you've seen, we've turned on the TVs for a while, and we're going to do four separate go-rounds with panelists. And again, we really want your opinions and your questions as we go through this, because you're really what this is all about. So thank you for coming out, and it kind of feels good that we're together. And this is really what it should be like, not just sitting home alone. I'm glad you're here. And let me introduce you to our panel for our first go-round. First, we are so happy to have with us Dr. Joe Swartz, congressman. He was a state senator from 1987 to 2002, congressman from Battle Creek from 2005 to 2007, and he's now a visiting lecturer in public policy at the Ford School, and we're very, very thrilled to have him. Mm-hmm. Next to him is our resident political junkie, geek, guru, you can call it what you will, Zoe Clark, half of Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics team, and also executive producer of Stateside.
Hi, everybody.
Yay, Zoe! And John Bebo, president and CEO of the Center for Michigan. I love this description, the nonprofit, nonpartisan think and do tank based here in Ann Arbor. So we're here for you tonight, and thanks to you for coming out and being with us. What are we hearing? I know there's phone calls being made. I was trying to check, but my Wi-Fi signal isn't happening, so I have nothing but blank pages. What are you hearing as far as turnout?
You want to start in,
what do you
in
think?
What you're hearing in Wayne County?
Well, we're hearing nothing but rumors. So,
well, that's fine. We're here drinking beer. What better
place? We'll all know the truth soon. Wayne County doesn't look as strong as I think the Democrats hoped. At least that's some of the buzz so far, which would be a rough sign for Mark Schauer. But we'll just have to see as the results come in.
And we should put some of this in context, right? The idea of why we're keeping an eye on turnout, particularly in places like Detroit. We'll also be looking at Flint, Saginaw. So, you know, Michigan, total Democrat state. We have more registered Democrats in the state. That is why for the past six presidential cycles, we have voted for the Democratic candidate for president. But we vote for a governor, a secretary of state, and attorney general in midterms, right? The years that there isn't a president at the top of the ballot. And Democrats don't turn out as nearly as much as Republicans do. That is an issue for Democrats all over the country. And so what we're looking at, and one of the things that Democrats absolutely have to do if they're going to have a chance to win the governor's race, is you have to turn the voters out. And so when we're looking at cities like Detroit, we're going, okay, you know, 2010, we had about a 30% turnout. Right now, we're hearing maybe 40%. Oh, I thought you were going to jump in.
No.
Okay. We haven't had nearly
enough
beer yet.
Very profound.
Yeah.
Zoe, I'm not getting in your way. No way.
So this is sort of what we're keeping an eye out. And Cindy, we've talked about this. Lon Johnson, chair of the Democratic Party, early 40s. He's married to Juliana Smoot. She is a former big-time fundraiser for President Obama, and he is basically doing everything in his power to make Democrats turn out. We had about 900,000 Democrats in 2010 that just didn't turn out to the polls. He thinks that if he can get at least 200,000 of them this year, Democrats have a chance. So that's why when we're talking about are there lines, what does it look like in these cities, it matters.
Well, the weather hasn't helped the Democrats. Detroit, Flint, Saginaw, you name it, my hometown of Battle Creek, and we'll see what happens, because the key to a Democratic victory in the gubernatorial race was turnout. I don't think it's going to make any difference in the U.S. Senate race, but in the gubernatorial race, it's turnout, and if folks don't turn out to vote for Mark Schauer, and let me preface everything with saying Mark Schauer is from Battle Creek, longtime friend, known him since he got out of Albion College, he's a good buddy. Rick Snyder's from Battle Creek. graduate of Battle Creek Lakeview High School. And his dad, Dale, wonderful guy, was a city councilman when I was mayor of Battle Creek. So they're both good friends. But the Democrats have counted on voter turnout, and I think it's going to be a little less due to the weather than perhaps they had hoped for or anticipated.
You know, we've got you here, Joe, for this segment, and it's kind of great to be able to talk to someone who has run for office, starting with the fact you started running for Battle Creek City Commission in 79. You campaigned in a mayoral race, a state Senate race, and a race for the seat in the U.S. House. How do you think campaigns have changed since you were in there swinging, for better or for worse?
For worse. They're mean. They are mean now. It used to be great fun to run for office back in the day, and I'm a gentleman of an age where I can say back in the day.
Joe, you're 39 years old.
I'm 39, actually going to turn 40 in 2 weeks.
You were four. You were four during your first race.
But it's tougher now. And it is the way campaigns are run, the things that people say serve as disincentives to good people who otherwise perhaps would run for office. But they say, why should I put myself, and perhaps more importantly, why should I put my family through this? So we have potential candidates out there who will remain potential candidates. They don't want to get into it in today's atmosphere. And quite frankly, I can hardly blame them.
I'm wondering what those of us who have never put ourselves out there running for elected office, what do we not understand about what that's like?
Well, it can be enervating. It can be difficult. It can be you can get angry. You can be absolutely happy at one moment and just mad as hell the next moment with all the things that go on. You're called names you never thought you possibly could qualify for. You have to say nice things to people that, quite frankly, under normal circumstances, these are people to whom you would not say nice things. It's all part of campaigning. It's part of the ball game, and those are the things that you have to do. And now, in addition, over the past 20 years, I believe it's become a little bit unpleasant. I used to love it. Used to love to do parades, all the things that we used to do 30 years ago in campaigns. They still do parades, but the next thing you walk in home in the morning and turn on the television and you find some guy on the television calling you the biggest SOB that ever lived. Well, maybe I'm an SOB, but not the biggest one that ever lived. So it's a little difficult.
What do you attribute that to? Cable TV, social media?
Money.
The meanness?
Well, people come in and support candidates from out of state. Remember, the consultants that come in from out of state and run your campaign for Congress or for the U.S. Senate aren't Michiganders.
Hired guns.
They don't give a rip what happens, what they say, what they do, who they destroy, because the day after the election, win or lose, they're back to D.C. or back to New York or back to Chicago or back to the bowels of hell in some cases.
Well, and I'd like to add a little context for those of you that don't know the backstory of the congressman's race that, you know, right now the whole establishment versus the Tea Party is something that a narrative that we all sort of take for granted, right? That's something that we all know about, that's been going on since we can remember. In 2006, the Republican primary, this congressman right here sitting in front of all of us, his race was the bellwether, I think one could say, of outside money coming in and looking at an incumbent congressman and throwing money down. And now the district is run by Congressman Wahlberg, who ran against this congressman here. And so what Joe is saying is not only accurate nationwide, but he really, your race was one of the first ones nationally.
I was the test case for the Club for Growth. That's the way it goes. It was a test case for a Republican running to the right of an incumbent Republican and saying kind of outrageous things, but that's happened now scores of times. And they don't lose too many. They have unlimited resources. They simply don't lose too many when they run to the right of someone.
Joe, the partisanship has changed, too. If somebody held a gun to your head, which I think is what it would take for you to run for office again, and said, we're going to shoot you if you don't run for governor, which party would you run in?
The Independent Michigander Party is the one that I would run in.
How has the Republican Party changed since the days when you were coming up?
Well, the Republican Party was based on the thinking person's conservatism. Bill Milliken, I think, would be the avatar of that. I certainly was and am a Milliken Republican, and that doesn't exist anymore. Ideology has taken over, and the ideology has fallen farther and farther to the right. The Republican base is only maybe 21 or 22% of the electorate. The Democratic base, maybe 21 or 22% on the hard left. And the rest of us are independents. But we've had a difficult time organizing. We have a difficult time falling in behind one candidate. And as a result, and it's especially true with the Republicans, the more extreme folks in the Republican Party, the Tea Party is a good example. God love them. They can feel about an issue any way they choose to feel. This is, after all, America. But I believe that they have, in fact, dragged the Republican Party too far to the right.
And the result that we're seeing in the electorate, as you talk about the fact that the big money and the consultants can do what they want, put a bullseye on anybody's back and take them out, doesn't that just make people feel that they don't count anymore?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons that this is a very important election in Michigan. You know, everything is up for grabs except the presidency of the United States this year, and you're going to find a voter turnout statewide is going to be somewhere 44-45%, if we're lucky, and in ways it's a shame, and in other ways it's shameful.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. What races, I'm going to start with you, John, what races statewide are you most focused on?
Zeroed in on the governor's race. I said a year ago that I didn't see how a Battle Creek Democrat could pull votes in southeast Michigan. I've been saying 52-48 for a year. I frankly don't care who wins. At the Center for Michigan, we are duty-bound not to care. We work with politicians who get elected across the sphere. I just didn't see how Schauer could do this. In recent days, with the buzz about turnout and Lon Johnson, we're going to find out soon whether he is a genius or a charlatan based on what the actual numbers are tonight. He has been pumping the media for a couple of weeks about how he's going to win the turnout game. We're about to see. That's the race to me. I think it's a fascinating dynamic between someone who wants to do policy but doesn't want to be a politician in the governor, and Mark Schauer, who has been running a campaign that has closed the gap much more than I think most observers thought he could. So we're going to be watching very closely a few specific counties tonight. Really, it narrows down to about six counties that we're watching in no particular order. Wayne, Washtenaw, Ingham, and Genesee, because those are the largest, very strong historical Democratic strongholds. It's worth noting that Rick Snyder actually carried Ingham County 4 years ago and nearly carried Genesee and nearly carried Washtenaw, and did far better in Wayne than any Republican in memory. We're going to be looking very closely in Bridge, if you read Bridge Magazine on Thursday, to see whether that moderate appeal that he seemed to have 4 years ago holds up and to what extent by looking at those percentages. And then there are two real swing counties, and they're big, they're outsized in their impact. That's Macomb and Oakland. There's 83 counties in Michigan. Those two make up 10% of the vote, and it's pretty close to being a swing vote. They both lean a little bit Republican in gubernatorial elections and a little bit Democratic in presidential elections. So it's those six counties, if you're a junkie and want to follow the results, they're going to tell you a lot about what happens tonight.
And, I mean, what you're saying, John, too, is I think, you know, the context is what the national story is right now, too, in a lot of Senate races and in a lot of congressional races, that what we're seeing right now is, 4 years ago, we saw a huge Republican sweep. 2010, I mean, just Tea Partier after Tea Partier came in, swept. Now, a lot of these governors, Scott Walker, who won initially, now are trying to figure out how to position themselves. And Governor Snyder, who ran as a moderate, who some will say has sort of abandoned some of those policies, other will say, no, he didn't abandon them. You know, he did them for political reasons, things like that. What we're seeing is whether or not he can run with the idea of give me four more years. And it reminds me a lot of how Obama ran in 2012. And so what we're looking at is I came in office, you know, the economy was horrible. You know, the patient was in critical condition. You gave me 4 years. I got him into stable condition. Let's see what I can do in the next 4 years. And so that's what he's running against. And so what's interesting, I think, is that we saw that that worked. And then all of a sudden, in the past couple weeks, we've really seen this shower candidacy sort of shoot up in a way that I don't think any of us were really prepared for. So I think that's absolutely, you know, what's going to be really interesting to watch, as well as we'll be watching a lot of the state house races. Because if Shower can get out the vote, it will help lower down on the ballot. And, you know, Democrats, they need 6 seats in the state house in order to have a little bit more power in Lansing. And so I'll be watching to see whether or not, you know, the state Dems say they'll be happy if they get 2 to 3 seats. If they've got 6, we could see some fundamental change in Lansing.
I don't predict elections because I'm frequently wrong, more frequently than I am correct. I'll say this only. Two good men are running for governor. One will win. A lot of good people are running for the legislature, both House and Senate. Some will win, some will lose. My prayer is that when it's all over, we can go back to what it was like when I was in the legislature, when I had a chance to work with people on the opposite side of the aisle, like John Cherry and Bob Emerson and Lana Pollock from here in Ann Arbor and others. You can't get it done as an ideologue, not communicating with the people on the other side of the aisle. And I hope and pray that when this is over, people understand this state has got some problems, and they're not going to be solved by one party at the expense of the other party, and vice versa. So my message, if I'm asked to convey my message to any of the winners, and if I'm not, I'm probably going to do it anyhow, is come on, ladies and gentlemen, work with each other. You're not going to get everything you want. Ask for a little bit more than you want. Take actually a little bit less than you need, but let's get some things done. That's the kind of attitude we need in the legislature. And quite frankly, that was the kind of attitude that existed in the legislature 25 and 30 years ago.
And when you think of the, yeah, that does deserve a round of applause. Well, I was just looking at some of the latest polls on the lack of popularity of both our president and the Congress. It's like, is it a race to see who could, you know, have worse ratings? But this isn't working for the electorate. Watching this, the antithesis of what you just described happening, it's not working for people. I know I had a long conversation with Paul Hilligans about that very same thing. That fact,
Paul Hilligans, former Speaker of the House, absolutely great guy. He feels the same way I do. We come from the same now non-existent wing of the Republican Party.
Well, and as he said, without the term limits, you could have you invested time, your constituents invested trust in you. You had a track record. If you made a decision that perhaps went against the ideology, well, still, they trusted you because that time had been put in. But when people are shuffled out the door so quickly, nobody has that time to build.
In the House, people are shuffled out the door before they even know where the men's room and ladies' room are. That's how quick it goes with term limits, and it's the blind leading the blind.
Any questions, folks?
Oh, come on.
Yes. In fact, our first person here, that's why he's sitting here in the main seat. Yep.
Yes, I wanted to know what you guys think the Detroit bankruptcy and how that's going to affect turnout.
Great question. I'm going to be watching how it actually affects the results. And you can watch the percentages of both Detroit and Wayne County votes that Snyder gets and whether there is good turnout for Shower or not. I wouldn't predict what it's going to be, but I think the results, those percentages, are going to tell you a lot about what the citizenry is saying in Detroit about a whole bunch of Detroit issues. The bankruptcy, the bridge, the Education Achievement Authority,
The Snyder camp feels like they're going to continue to make inroads in Detroit because they've been far more positive than most conservative Republicans would have been toward the city. It's a referendum on the governor's policies toward Detroit. He's never going to win Detroit. It's also a referendum for the Democrats on whether it was wise to run a West Michigan candidate for governor. So it's a great question. Couldn't possibly answer it tonight, but over the next couple of days, you're going to get your answer.
Yeah, I think a lot of us thought, too, that it was going to be a bigger part of the narrative, though. I mean, I remember 18 months ago trying to count, you know, when Kevin Orr, the emergency manager, was going to be voted out and thinking, you know, my God, it's going to be 3 weeks before the election. It's going to be what everyone's talking about. And really what we're going back, I think, and talking a lot about are some issues, education cuts, pension taxes. So I it's definitely going to be part of the scene, but I'm surprised, and I think some of our predictions, in fact, were wrong, you know, a year and a half ago, thinking it was going to play a bigger part.
Well, there's one other fascinating dynamic at work and play in Detroit, and that's Mike Duggan. He, don't forget, just a year ago, he won a write-in campaign for mayor.
Unheard of.
That took an incredible ground game. Where's that ground game? We're about to find out whether they were in play the last few days or not. And I've been arguing in settings like this that I think they probably weren't, because Mike Duggan is probably keeping his options open.
Yeah.
And a Mark Schauer governorship is in Mike Duggan's way potentially 4 years from now. There are all kinds of conflicting dynamics in this chess game this year. Terry Lynn Land, one of the worst U.S. Senate candidates in history, is an anchor around the governor's neck. That's not a partisan comment. That's based on the policy platform.
And I'm the king of Sweden.
There's just no policy platform there. But so you've got
mother John Bebo
of two.
Yes, she is. So you've got that anchor around the governor's neck, and then you've got the question of whether Duggan was going to turn out his ground team for Schauer. All of these things are going to show in the results.
Right.
I think that the county-by-county results are so interesting this time around.
Well, right, because let's remember if – oh, sorry, go ahead, Joe.
Only one comment about your question, sir. Rick Snyder is the only governor in 50 years that's had the guts to take on Detroit and their problems. And we all knew long time before he stepped in, went to the emergency manager situation, called in Kevin Orr, that – Detroit was going to fall, and Detroit essentially did. It had been falling for years. No governor in the last 50 years. Two governors served in the state Senate with Coleman Young, who was mayor of Detroit from 74 to 94. Coleman Young came to Lansing. He was treated like a visiting potentate, and people knew what was going on there. And so it goes with governor after governor. Rick Snyder has had the guts to face up to what's going on in Detroit. And for that reason, I will be quite honest with you, I believe he deserves re-election to get that job done. And that I'm not throwing any brickbats at Mark Schauer, who, again, is a good buddy of mine. But Snyder had the guts to do it, and he deserves our praise for that.
And based on the governor's activity in Detroit, he didn't leave Schauer a lot of room to run on issues in Detroit. You saw that in the one debate town hall they had. Schauer said he was against the bankruptcy, but didn't really say what he would have done differently, didn't really say how he would have done anything differently. And I think that left a real hole in how are you different? What would you have done?
We have another question back here. Here you go.
Thank you. I want to know how come the election in the East Coast, it seems to be that they are cleaner than the election in the rest of the states, and look like his money is playing a bigger role in Michigan and some other state, whether it's Kentucky or this other state. So it's a kind of like corruption, isn't it, to buy the election. Basically, the more money they spend, the better chance they have to get elected. This is more like there is no democracy.
Let me just say this. Term limits, which we have here in Michigan, it kind of eviscerates the legislative branch of government. And it puts a huge amount of power in the hands of the executive branch and lobbyists. And the lobbyists bring the money. The lobbyists represent their clients faithfully. They give them access to the process. But lobbyists dealing with a term-limited legislature is a total different ballgame than lobbyists dealing with experienced legislators who know when to say no, who actually do know where the men's room is, and can get things done. And if you run a poll on term limits, people still are in favor of term limits, and I hope I live long enough to find out that people in the state of Michigan understand it hasn't worked. But term limits draws money. You have three very populous states with term limits, and I think veteran politicians from any one of those states, California, Ohio, and Michigan, would say term limits don't work.
I used to cover, I used to be a reporter at the Chicago Tribune, where I think four of the five most previous governors are in prison.
In prison.
Michigan is quaintly non-corrupt. I really believe that. Of the governors I've covered in my career dating back to John Engler, I don't believe any of them were corrupt people. I don't think either of the candidates this year are corrupt. I don't think there's a lot of room in the legislature, the way it works, to wield power in a corrupt way, unless you want to talk about redistricting. But that's not corruption for cash in your pocket. It's corruption for power, and I think that is an issue. But compared to some other places, and let's not forget the toll bridge conspiracy in New Jersey last year, so maybe the East Coast isn't completely clean. But I think Michigan is quaintly non-corrupt.
I love that, quaintly non-corrupt. What a headline. We're going to wrap up this first session, our panel session, with some trivia, because we have goodies to give away. We have, what do we have? We have an Issues in Ale pint glass. What's not to love? And it's not even plastic. It's really glass. It's the real deal. And it actually, based on my many years of experience in Irish pubs, it's the right size. It's a real pint glass. I have a lot of experience.
No, it's true. We used to give away 12-ounce ones, and I was like, Steve, we got to change these. We're going to knock
yes.
on.
We have got to do real pint.
So, we're journalists. We are truthful. It is an actual pint glass.
So we have a trivia question. Let's test your political knowledge. Pop your hand up, and we'll run out and see if you have the right answer to this question. There is currently only one Democratic governor who is a woman. She's up for re-election this year. What state is she from? And I'm making it hard. Oh, right here. Let's see. No. Okay, we have another. Yep. Well, it is, yes, actually. But did I hear hear someone say New Hampshire back there? Oh, well, then it looks like.
And after that, you were going to Vermont and Massachusetts, right? good thinking.
All right, and we've got more to give away. We'll have more conversation sessions. We'll bring the results back up. I don't know about your my Wi-Fi isn't coming in too well, so. We give a chance to kind of turn our attention to the TV, see what we have going on, and we'll be back with more conversation with our panel members. So, again, order more beer, settle in. We're going to have a good night ahead. Thank you very, very much. And thank you, Joe Swartz, for being with us.
Thanks. Thanks very much. I have a 100-mile drive, so yeah. I'm going to hit 94 with all the trucks. Thanks,
well,
Joe.
Thank you, Joe, very much. John will be with us. Zoe will be with us. So we'll be back with you shortly.
The precinct's report.
Now we've got some of you folks thank there. You. We're going to be talking to where's some of you a bit later on as well.
I have a thank you, too.
You have a thank you. Fire away.
I have a thank you to my
John
three
Beeble.
Favorite voices in broadcasting.
You're such a sucker.
My fellow panelists. Really, you are. You're awesome.
Thank you.
Checks in the mail.
Love that. John Beeble from Center for Michigan, Zoe Clark, It's Just Politics, and executive producer at Stateside. And joining us, the lovely Jen White, who is Michigan Radio's All Things Considered host. She hosts a weekly political roundup with former Senate Majority Leader Ken Sikkema and Susan Demas, publisher of Inside Michigan Politics. So we're glad she could be with us tonight as well. Thank you, thank you. So any new news? I saw Zoe burning up the phone.
It's true. We are, and I've got to call the campaign to confirm, but it sounds like, actually it might be happening at this minute, that Terry Lynn Land is set to concede if she is not doing it at this very second.
I'm watching the audience.
She was set to concede at 8:15. It's now 8:18, and I'm having trouble getting online. So
I know I can't get on either.
So that is the latest. So it is looking like she will do a quick speech, and then she will be out of there, so that the losers don't ruin the night.
Can we talk a little? I would love the thoughts of the three of you. Honestly, how did that happen?
Well, I would just, this is probably poor taste, but her conceding this early is the most decisive thing she's done in this campaign.
Tell us how you really feel, John. Golly.
Look, it was an accident. I mean, it was not meant to be. She was not the chosen one. It was, you know, we sort of have these times where I don't know if Mercury was in retrograde or what was going on, but there was a handful of folks who all were kind of tap dancing around it. There were people that I were talking that were like, well, I'll do it if he doesn't, and if he doesn't, then I'm going to go, you know, and Terry was like, I'm doing it. And yeah. So she jumped in June 1. She sort of put this, said, I'm going to do it if no one else does. June 1st came around. She jumped in. And there were some other names that we thought, Mike Rogers, Dave Camp, Kurt Dykstra, mayor of Holland, who I think would have been a really interesting pick. And it turned, I mean, Bobby Shostak, the chair of the Republican Party, said on stateside over the summer, no, we want a primary. We want a Republican primary. We want to try to figure out the best candidate. She, you know, I mean, off the record, any top Republican official will tell you exactly what John is telling you on the record right now, which is that it was a horrible campaign. She was not ready for prime time, and people have been saying about, you know, her that about her for years.
What's a little bit ironic is she had a good reputation as Secretary of State. Yeah. I mean, she did a fine job. She had good people around her there. I think a lot of people expected more out of her in this campaign than she showed.
Well, and I think the moment of sort of awakening for us in the media, we were all on Mackinac Island together, and there was that very awkward moment when she was in a press scrum and just sort of had this panic attack and really ran away from the journalists who were there. And I think we were all like, wait, what just happened? What just happened? And that was the first moment, like, oh, this is not going to be pretty.
But she did try to use that, you know, as an advantage over the summer, this sort of, you know, mainstream media against her and tried to use that narrative, which didn't stick much because there was no
Mackinac
death. Well, that too. That
know.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, it kind of interesting when you think of covering the races and the ups and downs. And one of the big things was, A, her non-availability to reporters, where people had to email the campaign and get an email back.
We did the Michigan calling series, yeah. And, you know, I was dealing with all the candidates' people, and I'm totally happy to put this on the record, that we were not sure she was going to show up until the morning of, and it... You know, I was calling her campaign and texting them the night before, like, are we going to see your candidate? And it was not until Friday morning. The show was at 9 a.m. It wasn't until Friday morning at about 7:30 when we sent out a tweet saying, we're looking forward to having the candidate, and that her campaign retweeted it.
So
that
went,
was the
oh,
confirmation that we knew at 7:30 that she was actually going to be there. As an executive producer of a call
in the gray hairs.
State, I was going to say.
And then the whole question of debates and or the lack thereof of these big races. Do voters care? Do voters watch? Or is it more political reporters who are wringing their hands because they want to see debates? What do you think?
That's a good question. And, you know, as I talk to people, one of the things I'm hearing a lot is that people are sick of political ads, right? And that's becoming the main outlet for people to give their message. But it's not a comprehensive message. And people say, we want to hear these people debated out. So I don't think it's just the press or political wonks who want to see debates. I think people want at least to get a sense of how these candidates are when they're not scripted, when they're just off the cuff, when their feet are being held to the fire. And, you know, frankly, I think this is the most vocal I've heard the media be in a long time about, you know, where we're responsible in not holding politicians' feet to the fire and getting them to those podiums to debate. This is the first time I remember really that internal debate happening at this level.
Although I think John and I would probably be devil's advocates on this, and we've talked about this in past panels, that, A, I mean, did we learn anything from the town hall?
And yeah, that's a great question.
I mean, you know, we had the governor and shower there for an hour. Mm-hmm. I didn't hear anything I didn't know. B, not that many people watched. Mm-hmm. So people will say that they want debates. Mm-hmm. People will say they want to see it. It's actually whether or not people tune in or not.
I co-produced the gubernatorial debate in 2010 with Detroit Public TV. And a couple of days before the debate, I wasn't negotiating the questions that were going to get asked. I was negotiating the height of the microphones. Mm-hmm. And the whole process left me wanting as a viewer, as a producer, as a journalist. And I've really changed my tune on this over this. I worked like a dog that year to get sponsorship and line up that debate. I worked with Ken Sikkema to do that. And we spent the entire year. And in the end, we had no leverage. We had worked our tails off. And at the end, we were at the mercy of the candidates whether or not they were going to do it. And why did we get it? We got lucky in the end. And that puts journalists in a position that they are never in anywhere else. As journalists, you're in a position of negotiating and trying to market to get candidates to pick you. And I think that's very troubling. I think the very best dialogue we have that's unscripted with the candidates is Rick Plutus call-in shows on Michigan Radio.
And it also brings the public into the
discussion.
It does,
and it's unscripted.
In a really meaningful
and
way,
they can't prepare for that. Yeah. And I think that's fantastic. Steve Henderson at the Detroit Free Press has been pushing for a debate commission, and we had a really good, colorful conversation about this in a setting like this in Detroit last week. And I told Steve, I think he's wrong. I don't think we need a debate commission. I think we need an answer commission. I think what we need is for the 10 big media players in Michigan to sit down in January and say, these are the 100 questions we are not going to take no for an answer on. We're going to demand in-depth answers on these 100 questions, and we will surround them, and we will wear them down, and we'll get those answers, and we'll have a coordinated effort to publish those answers before the election. I think that's still somewhat scripted. But if you stay on them that long, they can't script for that long. And I think discriminating voters will be able to read that and get real answers. I think that's part of the picture.
And I think that's what it comes down to. It's how do we get answers? And then how do we disseminate that information to voters? Because I think, you know, we have a certain number of venues, for instance, Rick's show, that's public radio. And there's a certain audience for public radio, but there are a lot of people who don't listen to public radio. So what about the people who don't tune into DET or Michigan Radio or whatever? Where are they getting that information from? So I think this is the time to have that conversation, especially when we look at some of the stuff that happened with Rick's show, with Tyria Lynn Land's interview. I mean, that was an important conversation, and people needed to hear it. And I think we have to do a better job of forcing the issue and then disseminating that information to voters.
You want to add anything?
Oh, no.
Besides the gray hair you had that morning?
Right, and you're right, besides the gray hair. No, and that's exactly, I mean, that's how we did those shows, right, is exactly what John's saying, is we had to get in some negotiation about timing, but other than that, it was we gave them 10 Fridays from which to choose, and it was you have an hour, and I think it shows that they were willing to do that. The media is at fault for some of this. As John was saying, that the candidates play us against each other, particularly television stations, who rather than for the greater good saying, let's all get together and maybe air one debate or something like that on all the stations, each of them is vying for their own, and thus the lack of a debate commission or an answer commission.
And having been in TV news, there are times when they will work together. You can rely on a pool. I'll give you an example that wasn't political, but it was when the Gulf War broke out and when casualties started coming, we all put our big boy and big girl pants on and we agreed we would take turns so the poor families wouldn't have 2, 4, 7, and 50 on their doorstep. We would take turns and share and do that. So that is an interesting idea of could we pool and could we maybe put some of that competitiveness aside? Mm-hmm.
It's also not a new problem. I think the best chance always to have real, authentic debates is when there's no incumbent. So in 2018, I think this will wane a little bit, and there's a better chance we'll have debates. John Engler didn't debate Jeffrey Figer for obvious reasons. Figer would have torn him apart. Jennifer Granholm did debate Dick DeVos in 2006 as an incumbent, because if there is one thing that Jennifer Granholm could do better than almost any candidate Michigan will ever see, it was campaign and be in front of a camera. She was fantastic at it. So when incumbents feel like they have leverage in the upper hand, they'll do it. Otherwise, they won't.
I want to pivot a little bit, John, to a piece and change topics now. And we were talking earlier, but we've added some folks, about problems with turnout in a midterm. And I saw the piece today in Bridge by Ron French, Chastity Pratt, Dossie, and Mike Wilkinson on the Election Day Playbook. And they pointed out it's these state and local elected officials who have a much more direct impact on everyone's lives than whomever is in the Oval Office. So just why is it like political teeth pulling to get bodies out on midterm Election Day?
Well, again, it's not a new thing. This has been going on forever. I think a lot of people are casual voters. They come out, they get very passionate about the presidential elections, but they don't know as much about the state issues and maybe don't want to. And this is a long, long trend. You can go onto the Secretary of State website and see this forever. The great irony, Bridge raises this in every primary and we raise it in every general. A very small number of people are controlling how much money goes to your schools, whether or not we fix the roads, what the social policies are in the state. It's a very small percentage of the electorate that determines these in two ways. First of all, in the primaries, which is really where we've got 148 state legislators. Most of them are elected in August when most of us are not voting. And they're elected in primaries where people are running to the extremes because those are the voters who turn out. And in the end, this year, like most years, only a small handful of legislative races right now are actually in question. I think that's one of the biggest threats to good policy and democracy in our state. Campaigns are not being won on ideas. They're being won on hyper-partisan sound bites at the extremes.
And if I might, I might add, because I've been thinking about this too, you know, we did some youth policy forums across the state with statewide elected officials where we had young people actually ask the questions, and it was very interesting because I could tell they weren't expecting the questions these young people came up with. It was like, you know, well, what are you going to do to improve mental health services in the state, when what they were expecting was, when did you decide you wanted to run for office? So it was a very interesting, you know, an interesting conversation. But I think that there's also a basic misunderstanding about who's responsible for what, right? And as we see a continued breakdown of local news coverage, the people who are bringing you stories about what's happening in the legislature, and people are looking more to national news and hearing about what's happening in the White House and in Washington, D.C., that becomes the focus. And I think that part of what we're seeing, and like you said, it's not a new problem, but I think it's becoming a more serious problem because people just aren't hearing about what their legislatures are doing, that kind of really important hyper-local reporting that makes people understand that this representative is voting this way or this senator is voting this way. That's the kind of information people need to get engaged and understand, you know, what's happening at a state level, and we're losing that more and more. That's why what the work you do is so important, mm-hmm. you know?
To get that. Questions, comments? Anyone? Hands up, because we have a microphone so we can hear you. We want to hear from Ford people. Come on, you Ford people. Exercise your brain cells. Ask some questions. We do want to hear from you. One of the things we didn't get to in the first go-around, we were looking at some of the state races, and we were kind of talking around the office about why the AG race really hasn't gotten much attention. And I think it might have been Lester Graham who said, you know, we had Frank Kelly in there for so long that did we all just get used to that race kind of being on autopilot and we've kind of stopped paying attention, that got us out of the habit?
Well, it's always up against the gubernatorial race. And it's also up against the Supreme Court race, which was oddly quiet this year. And maybe it's partly because of the truth behind what Bill Schuette has described the office as being. You're the chief lawyer and corporate counsel for the state of Michigan. A lot of days, you know, that's not stuff that's going to connect extremely well with voters.
So just an update. I guess Terry Lynn took the stage, talked, but she hasn't conceded yet. So our reporter on the ground says she didn't concede, but everyone acknowledges the race is done. So we'll have to keep an eye on it.
Okay. We have a question from the audience.
I take back what I said about decisiveness.
Delete that.
You talked a little bit about the Supreme Court, and I'm guilty of this myself. I know who the governor is. I know who's running for the Senate positions. I have no idea who our Supreme Court candidates are. Should that be an elected position?
So there. I was watching, was it Flashpoint this weekend, and they were having a discussion about this. And this is embarrassing because I'm blanking on her name.
Bridget Mary McCormick.
Thank you, Judge McCormick was saying that, you know.
I just want to, like, braid her hair. The Supreme Court Justice, she's got the best hair.
You want to braid her hair, though? It's just weird.
There you are, sticking to the issues, Zoe. That's fantastic.
And what she was saying is that, you know, as they're making decisions, that they're not making decisions in chambers based on partisan affiliations. They're not. But where the issue arises is in people's perception of the judicial process and how trustworthy it is. When you have people running affiliated with one party or another, and you have money pouring into these races, and nobody knows where the money is coming, that it really taints the public perception of, you know, whether or not the judicial process is reliable. And that's where the real issue is. And that's coming from a judge on the Supreme Court. So that's her take on it.
On the question of whether they should be elected, boy, the Ford School students are here. I hope you write some master's theses on that question. Whether they should be or not, I'll pass, but the fact is they are. The good thing about what's happened in the news is the election guides are everywhere. At top of M Live today, you can go to Bridge, you can go to Michigan Radio. You can really cram on election day. I watch my wife do it every year. She doesn't give dip-do about most of the stuff I work on for a living, but she works really hard the night before the election. And you can see it in all of our readership logs and listenership logs today. You can cram at the last minute and find out about those, I think, better than you could back in the old days when we were killing trees every day and putting it on paper. But I do think it matters. The Supreme Court matters in some key ways that we get mixed up with in these elections. A lot of people will vote for or against a candidate for governor because they're mad at that candidate one way or the other on social issues. Governors don't really decide social issues, and neither do legislatures. Courts do. And that's where I think the Supreme Court is extremely important, and I do think it is partisan in Michigan. If you are an environmentalist, you're probably going to want to vote for the Democratic candidates for Supreme Court. If you believe that there's too much power in the hands of labor lawyers and liability attorneys, you probably ought to vote for Republicans for the Supreme Court. There is a track record there that the law is somewhat partisan when you come to the Michigan Supreme Court. And depending on where you are on issues like that, it matters. And it matters if you're concerned about social issues more than how you check that box for governor.
We have another question.
Yes, I know that in the last couple of weeks, Gary Peters has really pulled ahead of Terry Lynn Land, and we just heard that she's all about to.
She's conceited-ish.
She's conceited-ish. but they still say that the Shower and Snyder race has been neck and neck. And, I mean, if, beyond partisanship, what has made the biggest difference?
I think what's pushing people to vote in one direction or another?
In campaigning. You know, you're either going to vote straight ticket, and they say the party loyals are the ones that normally come out for these midterm elections. But we see a huge difference from the Senate race to the governor's race. And was it an issue of campaigning or an issue of just issues that were brought up in the campaigns?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily one thing. I mean, as John is saying, we saw a Republican Senate candidate who has run an awful, awful campaign. That's not to say that if there was a stronger candidate that it would be, as neck and neck as the Shower-Snyder race is. The Shower-Snyder races, let's be careful to say, you know, we've been watching a trend over the past few weeks that has shown Shower getting a little bit closer to Snyder. It hasn't been that way, you know, for the past year. I think one of the big issues with Snyder is some people just don't trust him, right? That there were plenty of moderates who came out and voted for him in 2010 and now just simply don't trust him. And Mark Shower has been doing as much as he can to start using that as bait for voters.
Your question is a great one, and Bridge Magazine intends to answer it definitively on Thursday. Now, that's when we'll really be able to look at the county by county vote totals and be able to show, look, we are the victims of spin every day by all the talking heads in both parties and all the strategists. My phone was ringing earlier. Somebody wanted to plant a bug in my ear before I came in here tonight. I don't know if what they were telling me is right or not.
The polls are going to show it. And then we'll be able to really say what won this and lost it. There are some key questions that we'll be looking at in Bridge. Did moderates suddenly abandon Snyder? Snyder did extremely well with moderates 4 years ago. He won all but a handful of counties statewide. He won Ingham County, which is a true blue county. He nearly won Washtenaw, which is one of the most liberal counties in the Midwest. He nearly won Genesee County, and he did very, very well in Detroit. That's a key question. How is he going to do this year in those areas? What happens in the two huge swing counties of Oakland and Macomb? And the key question is turnout. I've wondered for a year why the Democrats would run a West Michigan candidate for governor. There's a track record there that traditionally hasn't worked. If it does work this time, the party chair, Lon Johnson, is a magician, and he's headed to run a presidential campaign. These are all questions that are great, and I can't wait to answer them Thursday.
But I think some of the outstanding issues, especially when we look at the Detroit bankruptcy, you know, you have the Free Press endorsing Governor Snyder, which was, you know, everyone, there was this gasp.
Jaws dropped right, all you know? Over the
I
state.
I wasn't that surprised by that.
I was not surprised, but I... Knowing the people, some of the people at the Free Press and just, you know, being friends with them on Facebook and sort of, I think they were all sort of, oh, do we do this? Do we do this? There was a little hand-wringing, you know?
Yeah.
But I think it points to some of the tension that people feel about Governor Snyder and that he's not, I don't think any of us would say that he's passionate about social issues, right? Like, I don't get that from him. He's not. It's not that he's. What's
he
the word?
He looks at a social issue and runs away as
he's
fast
just like,
as he
okay,
can.
God, you know. But people were trying to make a decision, like who has a plan, and I think that's where the Mark Schauer issue was coming up.
Which is what we've talked a lot about. Is this a referendum on Governor Snyder? Or is this a referendum on not necessarily the best Democratic candidate that you could get to run against a Governor Snyder in 2014?
And you know, you're running against an incumbent. He has a record to run on, right? Mark Schauer doesn't have that. And so it's tricky, but I will read your piece on Thursday.
And again, it would be a different story if we were talking about a gubernatorial race in 2016 or 2012 when there was a president at the top of the ballot.
We're going to wrap up this session with one last question, and then we have two more sessions, so hold your questions, but we'll go ahead and take yours.
Thank you. Well, first of all, as to the Supreme Court, as a practicing attorney before the Supreme Court, I can tell you that whether a Supreme Court justice is designated Republican or Democrat is shorthand to know how they're going to vote on most issues. It just works that way for anybody who practices before the court, as at least as to the preliminary expectations. But more importantly, or to me personally, is the debate question you brought up earlier. I am an avid follower of debates, always. When they're broadcast, they're really critical to me. And I think that the problem with most viewers with debates is that the moderators, the people who do the questioning, are, for lack of a better word, cowards. I mean, they don't hold people's feet to the fire. They let the candidates just say what they want to say. And then just move on. I think Terry Lynn Land's conversation on U of M was rather instructive because every single time someone called in, her response was highly scripted. And it was very obvious that she had nothing to say about any of those key issues. And that was informative to those of us who listened. And and I think that even with public debates or the broadcast debates, if a moderator can come back and say, wait a minute, you didn't answer the question. This is the question. Do you have an answer? Even if the candidate doesn't give an answer, but instead follows back with their scripted answer, it's still informative. So I think we need to make sure the moderators have as much power in the debates as the candidates do.
I think you're absolutely right. Unfortunately, the moderators often don't have a lot of power.
Yeah.
In 2010, there was negotiation over some things that could be talked about and couldn't, and for how long. And that's because the way we're currently doing this, the media doesn't have a lot of leverage. The media could have leverage. Here's how. We're not taking a dime of your money or running one of your campaign ads until you agree to debate. The money changers, unfortunately, hold a little too much of the power over the journalism in that case.
We're going to wrap this session up, but we're going to do that with a trivia question to give you a chance to win an Issues and Ale pint glass. So hands up if you think you know the answer to this question. What state has a Senate seat that has never been held by a Republican? Ever, 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 ever. Put your hand, raise your hand up if you think you know, and we'll bring them up. Come on up here. We've got a possibility. We'll see. State has a Senate seat that has never been held by a Republican.
Say it again.
Hawaii.
You are absolutely right. Hawaii. Very good. Good job. Jen Mike, thank you. Zoe Clark, thank you. John Bebo, thank you. We'll take a break, go back to the TVs for a bit, get some more beer, and then we'll rejoin you in about 15 minutes. So we're going to pick up where we dropped off. Let's start with another question from the audience.
When a negative campaign ad comes on the TV, I can't dive for the remote fast enough to hit the mute button. And I'm just wondering, isn't there something that can be done to at least reduce the number of negative campaign ads? We hear they're there because they work. And
there are a couple things. One, report them to the Michigan True Squad so we can shame them. Yesterday was the third highest readership day in Bridge Magazine history, and most of it was people... Thank you. Thank you, Steve. Was that all you? Or
clicking and clicking and clicking and clicking.
Most of it was people watching the entrails of the 10 worst political ads of the season. And collectively, they are one heck of a collection this year. The other thing that we try to do in our messaging, in talking to campaign contributors, is ask them, just what is it are you investing in? And are you really getting your money's worth? This is what they're doing with your money. Have you thought about it that way? There isn't anything we can do about it. The federal court decisions are making it worse, and the First Amendment allows it. I wish we could rate the viewership on these ads, but I think the viewership is actually higher than we think based on what I see in our own traffic when we read these ads and call foul on them.
And again, I mean, what we're saying is that we know that they tend to work. And that's a really huge, big issue that's going to lend itself to one not wanting to change things.
An amazing amount of money. We had another question.
That's a great question.
It is
a
good one.
The questions. Keep them coming.
Yeah, keep them coming, guys.
So my question is, as media professionals, I feel like you guys, as media professionals, you guys have access to a lot of information and you've done a lot of research. Do you feel empowered to use that against politicians when politicians are saying things that are not correct or that are factually wrong?
What can you be a little more specific?
Just
when you say things that are the use against, and when you say
so,
that they're saying
are you do you feel confident that you can call out a politician who is stating an opinion, I guess, based on their political viewpoints that you know to be wrong based on your experience in the media?
Well, yeah, we had one debate this year, and the Bridge Magazine team, everybody was up until 4 a.m. that night doing the fact check on the claims that were made on the fly that night. And we called Liar Liar Pants on fire on some things. And that is part of the media's responsibility. I'm critical of our own business. I don't think enough people in our business know math. I don't think enough people in our business know accounting or spreadsheets. And I think you, the readers, ought to hold us even more accountable. To our defense, there are fewer of us doing more than ever before. And we're awfully tired about this time of year.
I don't know what you're talking about, tired. This is the best time of the year.
It's always running on sugar. And
I don't think you know
right
what
now.
Tired is.
Sure. I mean, that's our jobs, right? And if we're doing our jobs correctly and enjoying our jobs, then we get a little something out of when we can call folks out. I mean, I think that's one of the main things that we can try to do, and it's as we were talking earlier about the Michigan calling programs. I mean, that was something that we have fact sheets, right? Here's it's like this chess game. Okay, so here's the question that we're going to ask. Here's how they're going to answer it because we've asked the question or we've done our homework, and then here's the follow-up question. or here's how you're going to ask it a different way, or here's how they're going to answer it a second time, and here's how you're going to ask it a different way. So, yeah, I mean, I think if we're doing our jobs correctly, then absolutely that's we're using facts and information against a lot of the claims that are being made that are just inaccurate, or the ability to kind of stretch the truth in the way that you're seeing candidates do.
And at the same token, from just a production standpoint, I guess, for lack of a better term, you know, there are times when we don't have to concede the point, but you can ask a certain number of times, and if someone's going to stick to their answer, they're just going to stick to their answer. And so you have to, you know, you ask and you ask and you ask again, and if they keep repeating the same answer, even though you're challenging them with facts, the listener hears that too, or the reader reads that too, or the viewer views that too. But I think there's also, you know, a challenge in, you know, there's certain issues that people want us to say, tell them they're wrong, but it really is a matter of opinion, right? And so we're required to maintain that neutrality and the balance. It's not our job to project our opinion or anyone else's opinion to the government. We can say, well, you know, this group disagrees with you on that. But as a media organization, we have to be very careful about where that line, you know, there's a difference between numbers and opinion. So if it's about the numbers, then heck yeah. But, you know, there's some other areas where we have to be very careful.
And we have a question.
Hi. Do you sometimes depend upon your listeners being smart? Do you sometimes get a stupid answer from a politician while you're interviewing them and realize that your listeners are going to get the fact that they aren't answering intelligently?
Yeah. Yeah. And Cindy, I would love for you to answer this question. We've had a certain lawmaker on where, I mean, in the studio, we're looking at each other going like, wait, what? What did he just say? And yeah, I mean, we're gonna put that on air, absolutely, with the idea that you're gonna pick up pretty quickly that they are not answering the question,
especially in the context of a kind of a conversation that we'd have on stateside. I might rephrase the question, and if you still get the same lame answer, connect it.
And a pregnant pause can go a long way. I'll say that, you know.
Those are some of the best moments in journalism for us. An example from a million years ago. I used to cover Ann Arbor City politics for the Ann Arbor News. And at the time, we had a city administrator from the East Coast who was constantly fighting with the city council. He hated them. And he loved to give me things that would get them in trouble. And we had a city council member who borrowed the mayor's car to go to the Bill Clinton inauguration. And the city administrator turned me on to the records on this. So when I saw the councilman, I said, "Councilman, why did you take the mayor's car to the inauguration?" He said, "I didn't take the mayor's car to the inauguration. I took the mayor's car to Washington. I took the train to the inauguration." Those quotes are gold. We love it when they do that.
I want to ask our panel, we have a question? Go ahead.
Me again.
Oh, that's great.
I just wanted to shift back to the political ads conversation from a second ago. Was there a specific political ad that you felt was very effective this campaign season? I know there was one for me that I decided definitively I wasn't going to vote for that person after that ad, but...
Which one?
Terry Lynn Land had an ad earlier this season where she was attempting to convince female voters that they should vote for her because she's a woman.
And a coffee cup ad.
Yeah.
Labeled from the Washington Post as one of the worst ads of election 2014.
I found that incredibly insulting as a woman.
Google worst ads right now, and it is the first thing that comes up. Try it. I'm serious.
I found it incredibly insulting that just because I'm a woman, I can't understand political issues. So I think that just because we're both women, we'll vote for each other. It's not the way it works.
So your question, did we see anything particularly effective this
after
year?
That slanted question, yes.
I'm probably biased because the Michigan Truth Squad is always looking for the bad stuff. And frankly, I didn't see anything real effective this year. Four years ago, I thought Rick Snyder was effective by staying positive the whole time. I questioned his philosophy of really promising jobs because a governor can never deliver that. But he stayed positive throughout his message. This year, so many third-party folks have controlled the message with ads. What is it? The National Republican Students or something came out with an ad that I think was actually worse than...
The dress one? The wedding dress?
The wedding dress ad. And it was a woman getting her wedding dress, and it was the Mark shower, and it didn't fit right. It was ridiculous. What was worse is it was a stamp-out ad that was running in six or eight different states at one time.
Six different swing states.
Incredibly cynical. Why the candidates don't come out and say...
Stop this.
And Snyder did in that case, but he didn't do so very forcefully, and I really thought he should have. A lot of times when you hear that, I'm Billy Bob candidate and I approve this message, I'm going, why? Why did you possibly do that?
Did you watch the same ad that I just saw? My favorite is the Jody Ernst. She learned how to castrate pigs. Oh, so have me go to D.C., and you're just like, wait, I'm sorry, let's really break this down. And that's not too hard to do because I think it's pretty easy to hear what she's trying to say. But, I mean, these analogies are some of my favorite, you know. So I'll take that knowledge to D.C. and you're like, what?
Whoa. Please don't. Don't do that. Yeah, you know, I will confess that, you know, Zoe is our political, I hate using the word junkie. She's our guru. I am so bad about tuning out political ads. I just can't. You know, as soon as one comes on, I can think of one that was, to me, and the first time I watched it, I kind of couldn't believe it was airing. It was the Bernstein, A Blind Justice for All. I mean, that was... physically painful to me. I just sort of went, what?
Well, and sometimes we can see some of these ads sort of create some backlash. I don't know how many folks would have seen it here, but it's in the 11th Congressional District where Bobby McKenzie, Democrat, is running against Republican Dave Trott, trying to sort of name him the foreclosure king.
Right.
They took a story about a 101-year-old woman that he booted out of the house. And, I mean, man, that ad
hired an actress to play.
The Washington Post called the most brutal attack ad you will see of 2014.
I don't even remember what year this was, but it's the last effective ad, good ad that I thought I saw. It was a former state senator named Lawrence Wenke from the east side of Kalamazoo County. He owns greenhouses. And in a 30-second ad, he actually said what he was going to do in the next 4 years. And that's the last time I've heard that.
Bravo. Question.
Hi, I'm Nick. I'm a second-year Master of Public Policy candidate at the Ford
School.
Feels
like inside the actor's studio, doesn't it? I'm a second-year directing student. Sorry, Mike.
So throughout the campaign cycle and in the past, we've seen Governor Snyder be notoriously absent in leadership on issues of LGBT civil rights. Do any of you expect that if reelected, he would then take the stance that, yes, we do need to push forward an amendment on the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act?
I think, as Zoe said earlier, I think the governor runs from social issues every chance he can. I think he's trying to convince voters of something I said earlier, that largely those things are ultimately governed by the courts. As a governor, he just doesn't want to govern on social issues, period. Left, right, or otherwise, I really don't believe that. And I think that that's going to hurt him with moderates. I think a lot of voters want answers on these things. And he totally punted in the debate on that question. And I think your word for him was absent. And I think you're absolutely right. And I think he doesn't want any part of any of the social issues.
I think the LGBT rights issue is an interesting one for this governor. I think he's conflicted on it. I've talked to him a couple times about it. And in May on Mackinac Island, he finally came out. There are about 25 business leaders, big businesses, right? We're talking about Blue Cross Blue Shield, AT&T, coming out and saying it is time that we add LGBT rights to the state Civil Rights Act, the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act, making sure that you can't get fired for being gay, that you can rent an apartment if you're a lesbian and that someone can't deny you that. So all of these business leaders, some very well-known Republicans, in fact, all called on this. The governor came out, made an announcement on Mackinac Island and said that I want the legislature to debate this issue. And about 10 minutes later, Rick Pluta, my co-host of It's Just Politics, and I had a one-on-one sit-down with the governor. And we said, wow, you know, we didn't realize, we're surprised that you didn't, you know, give us some heads up that you were going to, you know, endorse this. This is big. He said, I'm not endorsing adding LGBT rights to the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act. And we said, well, okay, so but you're saying you want the legislature to take it up and debate it, but you're not saying whether you would sign it or not. And he said yes. And I, you know, what I keep saying over and over again, I'll continue to say it over and over again, is when does a governor ask the legislature to take something up and debate something and not give their answer or their reasoning on how they're going to sign it? And there are plenty of other issues that the governor will say are not on my agenda, that he's not ready to take up, that he doesn't deal in hypotheticals. But he doesn't ask the legislative body to take it up and debate it. And so this is a really nuanced position that he's taken, and one that I think it's going to be very interesting to watch over the next couple
of
years.
And notice some things that aren't on his agenda do end up on his agenda, right? Right to work, which we can debate all day whether that's an economic issue or a social one. I would argue it's largely a social one. But that one ended up coming to pass. I don't think he wanted that one either. I also don't think he got anything in return for doing something that he didn't really want to do. I think that was his chance to get a road deal very early on, and he didn't do it.
And that's what you get for someone who says he doesn't like to horse trade, right?
Yeah.
And once in a while you're going, okay, you know, that's admirable, right? We like this idea that you're not doing this for that. But a lot of political, you know, pundits will look and go, you really wasted, you know, your signature on that for and didn't get anything in return.
Question?
Yeah, can you hear me? I'm always told people can't hear me.
We can hear you.
Okay, thanks. Cindy, I want to tell you I really love your addition of your program to the lineup.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And I remember you when you were back on a morning show on another station.
Doing Battle of the Sexes and all those other silly things. Yeah, thank
you. And I remember thinking this lady belongs doing something way different, and you're doing it now, and congratulations.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much. Great, great team to be with.
My question is a couple of things. One is, even though we have a First Amendment, is it allowable for people to actually make scandalous statements, and statements are massively untrue about another candidate, and the other candidate can't sue them for defamation of character or whatever, like the stuff that Terry Lynn Land did to Gary Peters? Isn't that against the law? Or is that allowable in campaigning?
Well, I think that part of the issue is political nuance. You know, you look at the debate that went on about whether or not education funding was cut, right? And so you have this argument about who's telling the truth. And I think that both, and I'm going to defer to you on the legality part of it and whether or not that's even waters these folks would even want to wade into. But each candidate will make the case for why what they're saying is true. And it may be nuanced, but that it's true. But the legality part of it, is that something they'd even want to wade into? Because that gets, and both parties are guilty of it. That's the thing. Everybody's guilty of it. So
our friend down here who argues cases before the Supreme Court maybe ought to answer that question. I'm going to go back to law school and get a degree before I try.
Turn it off, I think.
Okay, I'm looking at the time, and I think we're going to take a break now and then come back and kind of dig in for the duration.
But the questions are really fun, though.
They
are. Keep them coming.
Keep them coming. Keep them coming, absolutely. But we have another trivia question, so let's see how your political acumen is. And at stake is an issues in ale pint glass. And let's see here. What state has a Senate seat that has never been held by a Democrat? The last time, what state has a Senate seat that's never been held by a Republican? This is what state has a Senate seat never held by a Democrat? It's like the big question at Jeopardy. The end. Any clue? Do we have a hand? All right, we've got a hand up. Let's see if that's the right answer. Let's see. Now I'll go a little further north and a little further east.
Do you guys know?
Oh, all right, hand back down. See. I'm trying to think what kind of the Green Mountain State. You want to try? Nope, got to go further north.
Vermont!
Yes, very good. Further? Keep going. All right, we'll take a little break. Go back to the, check our phones and check the TV, and then we'll be back for our final session and take it on through. So be thinking of some more great questions. You guys are awesome. Thank you. All right, let us get into our fourth go-round with panel discussion here at the Election Night 2014 edition of Michigan Radio's Issues and Ale. I'm Cynthia Canty, host of Stateside, and we want to thank you so much for being here and bringing your ideas and your questions and your energy to our Issues and Ale, and we'll be looking for questions from you, and they've been coming, they've been great. Now, we have two new faces on our panel. Of course, we still have with us John Bebo from the Center for Michigan. Yay, thank you.
I'm sorry.
Jen White, Michigan Radio's All Things Considered host. And with us are a couple of folks from the Ford School of Public Policy. You are Master of Public Policy students. All right. First, we have Lauren Burdette, and next to her, we have Ruth McDonald. Lauren, tell us a little about you.
Sure. So I am a second-year Master's in Public Policy student at the Ford School. I'll go backwards and chronologically, I guess. I taught for 3 years on the south side of Chicago, middle school math and science. Before that, I was at the University of Pennsylvania. But originally, first 18 years of my life was in Kansas. So pretty exciting night for us.
And you have worked on mayoral, congressional, and presidential campaigns.
I have, mostly in Pennsylvania, but also in Kansas, and volunteered a little bit in Illinois.
Lauren. Ruth, tell us your story, because we got Lauren's, and you've worked on campaigns, but you, Ruth McDonald, have some real experience on the Hill.
That's right. I just came off the Hill, where I worked nearly 7 years for two different members of the House of Representatives. And throughout the last 15 years, I've worked or volunteered on about 10 campaigns, from sort of local city council all the way up to presidential to congressional.
All right. We will like to get, we'll look for your insights and views. We've got a little bit of news. John, you've been checking.
Yeah, a lot of you probably already know this, but the Free Press has called the gubernatorial race for Snyder, using the words he has cruised to victory, according to their exit polling and analysis of key precincts.
Which will tell you what about how this night will go throughout the state, do you think?
I don't know. I read it Thursday. We're going to go county by county and show you exactly who won where and whether it was expected or not. And I think it's going to say a lot about what the Michigan public statewide thinks about the governor's first term. And we'll have to wait for a few more details. But the Freep has put itself out there, declaring a victory for the governor.
And you were saying before we started tonight, if we were talking yesterday, you might have...
We did a lot of modeling based on turnout. And the Dems have been pushing the story for a couple of weeks that their turnout numbers were very, very good. And so we ran some models based on higher than normal turnout, and at about 3.25 to 3.5 million votes, it turned towards Snyder, based on any kind of predictive measure you can make based on historical vote totals. This suggests that turnout might have been down today. I've got a couple of messages that came in the past 3 hours that especially absentee vote in Wayne County was down about 25% as of the same time 4 years ago, as of mid-afternoon. That was an early sign to the Snyder camp that they thought they were in pretty good shape. There's also 32,000 fewer voters in Wayne County, which is the statistical home of the Democratic Party in Michigan, than there were 4 years ago. So it was a surprise to a lot of us that Shower was supposedly closing the gap in the past couple of weeks, because there wasn't much to suggest before then that was happening. But based on the buzz yesterday, we were running some models based on higher turnout that said that this could be very close. So what this suggests to me is turnout hasn't been that high, or Snyder has maintained a moderate base that crosses over. And we'll just have to wait to see and analyze the results a little bit more.
I want to ask our Ford School Master of Public Policy students, what did you feel through the election? What was the most interesting thing that you watched or you saw through this election cycle?
I think I pay probably more close attention to Kansas than most people do, but I think that that race is pretty interesting in terms of, I mean, this is expected to be a pretty big victory for Republicans tonight, but I think Kansas shows that there is a line where you can go too far to the right, and voters in a pretty conservative state are going to kind of backlash, and I think that that's a really important lesson for Republicans nationally to pay attention to. So I think that's interesting, and especially with the Libertarians and other states that are running, just an interesting year.
What do you think that line was in Kansas?
I think it was the tax cuts that eventually led to a steep drop in education funding. Kansans are really proud of their public education system, and as a product of it, I was very pleased with it as well. And they, you know, I think that even across the western part of the state, they are feeling that there is this sort of line that Brownback crossed in terms of the amount of funding they're willing to cut.
And what do you think, Ruth? What grabbed you the most?
Well, I thought it was a very exciting campaign, and obviously most of the people's eyes were on the Senate and then, of course, the governor's race. But there was also a period of time where you could have actually had four, it was feasible to have four independents win in the Senate contest across the country. So you would have had more independents in the Senate than we've ever had, and kind of interesting caucus issues there. And in some real surprise states. And I think the other thing was the late surge we saw in a couple of states, South Dakota being one of them. Alison Lundgren Grimes coming up from behind. She lost tonight, but she was left for dead. And then sort of, you know, by her, the DSEC, and then also, of course, you had cable news pundits basically saying she should just drop out, and look how close she got. So I think it's really kind of, it shows again sort of the electorate's very uneasy. They're just very uneasy this year, I think.
You've worked on Capitol Hill, so you've been there, you've seen the workings, you've gotten to know legislators. When you see how rotten and lousy approval ratings are for Congress as a whole, from the speaking of an uneasy American electorate, what do you think? What does that make you feel?
Well, as a congressional staffer, it was, I mean, you weren't going to win any popularity contests. It wasn't something that you would say when you went in for a dentist appointment. Hey, am I? But, you know, but.
No Novocaine for you.
You know, I think it shows sort of a progress. Americans have had a very difficult last decade, between 2000 and then, you know, so I guess it's a decade and a half now almost. And so there's a lot of reason for them to be dissatisfied. But then I think you also have, you know, we had 2 years where we had literally the most productive Congress in modern history. That was 2008 to 2010. But then you basically had huge gridlock, and that's what you still have. And so I think Americans saw, you know, between the government shutdown, of course, even when we had the most productive Congress in history, people were very still unsettled because you also had the debt run up and, you know, the bailout here, the auto bailout. So there was a lot of reasons, even though Congress was doing a lot. And whatever your opinion is, in my opinion, I think they helped save the economy. But if you disagree with me, you know, people were just not happy with Congress. Sort of like damned if you do, damned if you don't. And so and there are a lot of reasons for that.
I was reading before I came here this evening, NBC had a story, was it like an early election story, about the fact that millennial voters really, really were not well represented on this election day nationally. Why do you guys think that is? I heard a boo from somebody who was there. But, you know, what do you think, Lauren? Why is that?
So we were actually just talking about this during the break, and I think that we're a group that, you know, the first presidential election I voted in was Barack Obama. And, you know, the excitement of the first African-American candidate running for office led people to go to the polls, even though we may think that the process is a little bit antiquated. This is a generation that has Twitter, we have smartphones, we have, you know, everything at our fingertips. And voting, I mean, today, even when I went to go vote, it was kind of funny, like how kind of, it felt like almost the 1970s, which, I don't know, seems like a long time to me. and I think that, you know, it's
Jen,
it's
Jen, John, and I are going to cry now.
I feel like I need to, like, cradle her and hum her a lullaby now.
The 1970s were awesome.
A lot of good stuff.
We'll take your word for it.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, we're a very mobile generation. I think that in this room we represent every time zone in the country and in terms of origin. And getting an absentee ballot is a pain. Some states it only counts provisionally, even if you send it in. Other states, you know, it's just hard to figure out what the deadlines are. So I think that millennials are so mobile and so ready to kind of, like, get something immediately that we got to figure out some kind of way to entice them.
Same-day registration.
That would be helpful.
You're also huge, but have you really defined yourself yet? You had a lot to do with Obama. Rand Paul thinks you have a lot to do with him. Yeah. You have a libertarian streak. You have a distrust of government. You're statistically maybe distrustful of big corporate employers. Mm-hmm. You're enterprising. You're entrepreneurial. This is all from the Pew and Gallup studies. But who are you as a voting bloc, or are you a lot like the rest of other generations who are pretty split?
Well, I think, you know, you're seeing the younger voting bloc is more liberal on social issues. Gay marriage is obviously the most prominent example. But like you said, you know, there is also this distrust, and I think that's somewhat inherited from their parents. And then they've also, of course, you know, they're coming into the labor market at what is a pretty bad time to come into the labor market. So, again, it's that unease that you see playing out, I think. And I think it's also just sort of a reflection of kind of the movement in our society. I think, you know, their parents are probably less politically engaged than their grandparents are. You know, we're further removed from the New Deal. And so I think you get some of that sort of, it's just sort of a continuation here, and it hasn't hit rock bottom yet. But I think that's part of what you're seeing is sort of just a continuation in one direction.
I have been clipping out and saving a big fat file of opinion pieces throughout this campaign from many different newspapers and magazines and websites. And the pretty common theme is, voters are gloomy. They are not happy with the status quo. One headline was the campaign of disgust. It just seems very much painting a picture of a dark, dark place that the American electorate is in. John and Jen, do you buy that? Are people just trying to get you to click through and read their story in the New York Times or wherever? But what do you think?
I don't know if I buy it, and I focus just on the Michigan electorate, so talking about the American electorate is really, I'm probably the least qualified.
Well, the one story that caught my eye was the New York Times, and it was about Michigan. And even though there seems to be recovery, voters still feel gloom. That was that perspective.
We didn't find that. We do more than 150 community meetings around the state. We do statistical polling to match up with the live polling we do in the meetings. We actually found in our report, we were on your show talking about this, Cynthia, back in the spring, voters actually felt more hopeful this year than they had in the past because the economy had been better. For a lot of you who are from different time zones, if you want to see bleak, you needed to be here in 2007, 2008, and 2009. This was a bleak, bleak place. And I think there's some upswing from that. I think there's also a real... a demographic chasm between some people who feel hopeful and other people who feel like they've lost some rungs on the ladder up the American dream. And I think it has a lot to do with your demographic status in this country about how you feel. We saw very different senses of gloom or hope based on where you are in the economic strata in Michigan.
And I agree with John. And I also think, you know, there's a difference between how people feel, you know, about their position in life and whether or not there's some place for them to go or a way for them to build in an upward trajectory, and the way they feel about the way their government is operating. You know, I think they're, if you read almost any publication about, you know, how Congress is functioning, yeah, you feel pretty gloomy. I mean, it is... you begin to feel like, okay, if this is our representative government, you know, yeah, I don't feel good about this. So I think there's a few things at work, but I agree with John that there, you know, people may feel like they are making up ground, but they're making up ground because they have lost. You know, they've slid back somewhat. So then that's a reality.
I think that's there's also an interesting point there. Actually, what you're seeing right now, though, if you took a snapshot, is really an upswing in the economy right now. You've got the Dow twice as high as it was when Obama took office, gas prices below $3 for the first time in many years. You know, employment is now the lowest it's been since Obama took, or unemployment's the lowest it's been since Obama took office. But the electorate's not yet feeling it. They're not absorbing it. And frankly, the media is not covering it as much as they are sort of the horse race.
Well, that liberal rag Forbes just said today that Obamacare is working.
Right. Well, you know, right, more Americans covered than have been in a long time. So, but it's not, it hasn't sunk in yet.
And I also think it depends on how, you know, we're at a time when people are choosing who they listen to, right? And so even if the numbers say the economy is improving and we've got, you know, lower unemployment and gas prices are low, if the media outlet you're using is sending the message that the company is in the deep, dark spiral of Ebola doom, then that becomes your reality. That becomes your reality. And so I think that also plays into what we're seeing.
And I think a lot of us don't, a lot of Americans live in their little silo of what they choose to consume. And that it might be the things that they put on their Facebook wall that just reinforces what they believe. And you're not welcome to and encouraged to look outside of that silo.
Well, I think also, too, it hasn't hit Americans' pocketbooks the way they would like to see it. So there is also that dynamic, but the point is that we're on the upswing, not on the downswing, but there's not the optimism there.
Question. Yes, we do. Oh, I love you. You're earning your keep tonight.
Well, welcome back.
Let's just one more try. Come on up here so we can hear you. Yeah, come on up. Come on up here. Here. I'm going to give you that.
Well, I, too, am a millennial. And when we're talking about millennials, I think that we are also influenced by my parents were boomers, and they had a very distrust for the government via Nixon. And that was impressed upon me. But I think that now we are a generation of social media. Today on my Facebook wall, I noticed there was a post about I voted, and I also saw an NPR post about how this is actually influencing the elections. Do you think that social media in the future will play a significant role in getting millennials to the polls?
I think it already is, as evidenced by today. But also, I think even in the last 4 to 6 years, you've seen, I mean, that's how Obama's ground game kind of was so effective. The ability to connect with friends, the ability to use computers and also connect with people in your community is something that we really enjoy. I mean, I think you see that in every industry now, in Airbnb and even Uber. You know, you've got these connections to your society that is made possible by social media.
Are you ready to not only participate but lead? Who are the leaders of the millennial generation going to be?
Who are they for the older generation, I would argue. I think...
Burn!
I mean, the Republican Party still doesn't know what candidate they're going to run in 2016. You know, and frankly, the only ones that are available to run are the younger ones, like Rand Paul.
That's an opportunity. So, this is what I'm saying. So what are you going to do? They love you. You got a vacuum. Go use it.
I don't know. I think
we're old and tired. We're looking to you. Help us.
You heard John. He's old and tired. He's looking for help.
Well, I also think John Oliver had this really interesting sketch about state legislatures on Sunday evening, and I think that the number of state seats that run, the state representatives that have run unopposed, is in the hundreds, almost what, maybe 1,000, and I think that I am at least have become very interested in state legislatures as a potential place of change. And I think that it's really interesting the psychology of people who go into state races, because you tend to not get a lot of media attention. And you don't, I mean, wouldn't recognize my state rep if he walked in the door, although I would actually after last night researching. but you know, it's a different type of person than who runs for
like Congress or a president because you get such less like exposure. There's a different psychology there, and I think it'll be interesting to see if people in our generation are able to step up and like maybe they'll like that kind of behind the scenes thing, but maybe they'll want more of the kind of attention that national races get.
You're singing from my songbook because I think state legislators are a great place, a great laboratory for change too. And I think it's where a lot of the action is. Mm-hmm. I mean, things actually get done at the state level. Yeah. And I'm not just saying Michigan. I think things, policies change when you elect different people at the state level. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think it's a little bit more in front of voters' eyes than it is at the federal level.
Anybody with questions, please. Oh, we have a question. All right.
Go for it. We think this is going to work. It is. So you turn back the clock a year, and everyone would have been talking about the failure of healthcare.gov. And it's surprisingly sort of silent this year about Obamacare, and at least in these elections. So I'm wondering what people think about both what that means for healthcare.gov, what it means for the election that we had so little talk of Obamacare, and then what it means for healthcare, what it means that about expansion and the future of expansion that we've heard so little talk about it.
How quiet it's been about the health failure a year ago of healthcare.gov, and what are your thoughts on what? It was very quiet, was Right to Work very quiet.
Well, it wasn't quiet there for a while.
In this election.
But there hasn't been a long tail. I thought there would be a longer tail because that was a pretty major foobar there for a while. I mean, come on. But, I mean, now you're seeing a different dynamic. When Forbes says that Obamacare is working, the fact that the website didn't work a year ago kind of becomes a second story.
And you have Republicans. I can't remember who it was. Republican candidate for was saying that he said it was time to let it go. It's time to let that fight go. You know, we've got to move on to issues that we can actually see some movement on. So I think that just the overall, it's like, how long can we fight this battle?
Do you think, Jen, that did that happen with Right to Work? We actually did a segment on Stateside about that, because think about where we were at two years ago.
2 years ago, when I talked to Ken and Susan, they were saying this is going to be a major issue in the election, and it hasn't been. And I think part of it is because, you know, the union doesn't have the strength it had before, but I expected it to be more of a talking point.
I don't think it's been a huge issue for a couple of reasons. One, economically, it doesn't matter. Either way. It doesn't move the needle either way. Secondly, fewer than one in five households in Michigan are union members now. It's a very different Michigan than the glory days of labor. And so the impact on kitchen table politics for a lot of families, maybe theoretically or thematically, they might not have liked that if they're card-carrying Democrats, but it actually impacts the reality, the security, the pocketbooks on a regular basis of fewer and fewer Democrats. So ultimately, I think those are some of the reasons why it hasn't turned out to be a huge issue.
And people were upset about the way Right to Work passing in the lame duck session, but that doesn't fit well into a campaign slogan, right? So you can't, it's hard to make a political ad around, they didn't pass this law the way, you know, that's not 30 seconds, so.
Because didn't Mark Schauer take a tear gas shot to the eye or something, even outside during the protest during that? All right, let's play what if. If Republicans win control of the U.S. Senate, you'd have every Senate committee chaired by a Republican. Who wants to predict the political climate of our nation as they slow walk legislation or don't even take up a bill? What will that look like, do you think?
This is exactly why I stay in state politics and state journalism.
I'll try not to sound too biased, but I think I have a couple of thoughts, but one of them I think is you will see some action on some issues. Whether they're really the issues the American people care about is another thing. And I think, you know, we might see movement with tax reform, but what kind of tax reform is that really going to be like? And so I think that's going to be interesting to watch. But frankly, the Republicans have sort of at least in the House, have shown themselves incapable of passing legislation, even at very critical times. You have the government shutdown. You had the debt ceiling debate. Anytime there's been sort of a must-pass legislation, you see it again and again with the appropriations. They just can't pull it together in time. So we'll see. Boehner still has a very raucous, you know, membership. So, you know, he's still got a
raucous caucus.
Okay, yeah, so I guess caucus.
At the circus bar.
Hey, we've been here all night, and we haven't talked about one of the more entertaining sideshows in Michigan politics, the 11th. The two's a race, three's a crowd. What have you thought, John, as you've watched this unfold with, you know, Congressman Benvolio getting trounced by Dave Trott and then deciding, my angry constituents want me to do a write-in? Could that send Bobby McKenzie and the Democrat to Washington?
If you can be Santa, you can be a write-in, okay? I'm really sorry to disappoint you. I have very little to say about that race. I've paid very little attention to it other than some of the bad ad claims, because I just don't work in federal issues.
Fair enough. I want to go back to what John was kind of throwing the gauntlet down at you guys a little bit. But in our first round of discussions, we had Congressman Joe Swartz, who pointed out, we talked about people running. Like I said, how did Terry Lynn Land happen? How did that happen? And finding good candidates to run. And he said, it's so mean. You know, that's the difference from when he was running for state and for Congress. It's gotten mean. And people look and go, I don't think I want to do it. And so to you guys or those of you here from the Ford School, what will it take for your crowd to say, we're willing to give this a try? What will it take?
I mean, I actually took Joe Schwartz's class last semester, and we talked about very similar issues, and we actually went around the room, and he asked people, if you had to run for office, what level would you run at? And like 95% of the room said something on executive, like mayor or governor, not president, not Congress, which I think is pretty like revealing about where we think the power in our society lies as our generation. I think he's right, though, right? Like, it's mean. I mean, the main reason that I wouldn't run for office is because of what it puts your family through and because of the money. I mean, I feel like it's so difficult, even if you want to remain true to what you believe in, it is so difficult to even, like, the perception, because you have to get so much money, the perception is always going to be there that you are voting based on whatever the people who gave you money think. And I think that, I mean, Citizens United made that a little bit challenging. I don't kind of know where we're going with that in the future, but I think that something there has to change if we're going to get kind of committed social servants to go into government and not making change in other kind of areas of society.
Well, I think that's speaks to, you know, the distrust in government is kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, the more you distrust it, the more you're less likely to be able to recruit candidates. And frankly, with the money, you know, you also have to recruit people who are willing to fundraise an awful lot. And I think that's a real big impediment. It's not only that, you know, nobody wants to be the guy who's getting attacked all the time, but you're also just raising money an incredible amount of time. And I think that's something candidates really have to come to grips with. But, you know, so I think, you know, it's going to change basically the attitude of the country has to change. And I think also, you know, people run because they think they're going to win. And so, you know, the optimism is something that can be very powerful.
I also think the partisanship is kind of interesting. One of the first people who I volunteered for was Representative Dennis Moore from Kansas. And he, very moderate Blue Dog Democrat, who said one time, he said, you know, when he was first elected to Congress, Republicans and Democrats used to, they had this like retreat they would go on together with their spouses and sometimes their families as well. And he said that was how, I mean, and he was in a unique situation being a Democrat in Kansas, but he said it just really helped get people to know each other. And I think that, you know, that those kind of institutions in government have to come from leadership. So that's going to have to come from whoever's like majority leader or, you know, head of the party. And I think that that's something that we could very, I think, easily integrate into our society now and would really help kind of bridge some of this, like, you know, partisanship we're seeing, polarization, yeah.
Can I go in a totally different direction for a minute? Maybe start a fight?
Go.
I'm a Gen Xer, so I've spent my whole life being bossed around by people older than me, and I'll spend my later years being bossed around by people who are younger than me, which is just fine. I take orders really well. There's a really, really smart policy person in state government who has been talking to me over lunch about starting in a American Association of Young People to go up against the AARP. I'm interested in your perspective on the generation gap here. And I'll bring it down to a state policy level. We've got a pension tax now in Michigan for some people on pensions. And part of the theory that the governor was selling on that is this is to make it fair, make the system more fair. And why should the older people who have more money than the younger generations be underwritten by the younger people who have huge student loans and are struggling to get by? What's your take on generational finance issues, whether they be things like pension taxes or Social Security, and how much is that going to drive politics for your generation?
Well, I think that's a big deal. Traditionally, our society has definitely invested more in seniors than they have children and younger people. There's a reason for that. It's because seniors used to be in incredible poverty. Now that we've invested in them, children are the ones that live more in poverty than seniors. So I think, what you're going to see, though, is that young people have to become more engaged in voting. One of the reasons why we continue to hold on to sort of the funding mechanisms that we have is because seniors are such a powerful vote. They're a big part of the electorate. And so I think, one of the things is if younger people sort of understand the issues at stake here and kind of the trajectory of financing for a lot of the programs in this country and that sort of thing, maybe they'll get engaged. But it's a hard concept, I think, for people to grasp.
So what goes away first, the 99-cent pancakes at IHOP for seniors or Social Security?
I don't know what you're getting at. However, I'm more than happy to pay an extra dollar for a Big Mac if it means people are going to be earning a living wage. I think... I don't know the answer to that.
Let me get the thoughts of our panelists. Looking ahead, what's next? So tomorrow, whatever will happen, will happen. We'll chew everything over. What do you see happening in Lansing in lame duck between now and year's end?
Got to know more about the results. If the Free Press is calling it for Snyder and they're right, that means that the Democrats surely could not have won the state house. Generally a slower lame duck than if Schauer had won. I think Republicans would have tried to rush through a whole bunch of stuff and probably including some controversial social issue stuff. I think it could go either way on one of the governor's biggest priorities, which is a road funding deal. He might be able to convince some Republicans who are term limited on their way out to push that over the top. Randy Richardville could not get his caucus in the state Senate to do that. Or they may just sit back and say, we got a lot of time to figure this out. We're back in the majority everywhere, and nothing might get done for a while. That's my take on the state level if the Free Press endorsement is, or if the Free Press call on the governor's race is correct.
What do you think, Jen?
What I'll be interested in talking to Ken and Susan about once we have a better idea is whether or not we're going to see movement on Elliot Larson in lame duck. And now that we have the Chamber of Commerce coming out and saying either you get a transportation funding bill together or we're going to do it, I'm really curious to see what happens with that too. I mean, clearly that is the biggest issue for voters across the board, and the fact that we haven't seen movement on that is nothing short of a travesty. It's ridiculous.
And Rich Studley is, when I talked to him, he was like, do your job or we're going to do it for you.
Yeah.
They're mad.
And I mean, whatever they come up with, if it ended up on a ballot, I think Michigan voters may be at the point where they would pretty much sign off on anything that didn't help make us have to replace, you know, two or three tires in a winter. So that's what I'll be curious to see.
I think also, again, this is predicated on whether the FREEP is right. Yeah. I think there'll be some big questions in the Democratic Party. I don't think you'll see them run an out-state candidate for governor anytime soon. I think all eyes will be on Mike Duggan as a potential savior for the party in 4 years. And I think there will be a lot of questions about whether the party is broken. If it trends the way it's trending tonight, Jennifer Granholm will be the only state-level state candidate elected by the Democrats in 2 decades. That is a losing streak worse than the Chicago Cubs, and it suggests the party's got some big problems.
And what's interesting about Mike Duggan, you know, he already has strong relationships with Republicans in Lansing. You know, he kind of pulled off a bit of a hat trick in Detroit, I think, according to, from some people's perspective. I was not surprised that he won. But having those roots in Detroit, I think, is going to play very well for him long-term if he has larger political ambitions. If he sort of has that as his proving ground, I think he'll be someone to watch very closely, very closely.
Question.
This sort of plays to that, because what I saw going on prior to this during this campaign is massive, massive, massive Republican coverage of everything, because they have so much more money than the Democrats. Now, one thing I saw, I've been watching the Canadian election stuff as they're preparing for their big election, and they have a 2-month window. That's it, that they do their advertising on. And I am so sick of political stuff at my door, on my phone, on the TV. I would love to see us limit this. And that way, maybe every party would even have a little more money because it isn't spread out over 2 years. Have they ever talked about that, or have they blocked it completely because of the money they want to invest on the part of the Republican Party?
Part of the money issue is part of the money issue is for the Dems. There's really only one source of money, and it's big labor. If you look at the state political action committees and who's supporting Democratic candidates, it's a real issue for the party's future because they have one source of money. They're not very diversified in terms of I think it's a very diverse party in terms of interest, but in terms of financial support, they've got one source, and I think that drives a lot of policy. And as we talked about earlier, the numbers don't add up. It's fewer than 1 in 5 people are in unions now. It's much different than it was in the 70s or even the 80s and generations before, where big labor represented a lot more people. Therefore, the Democratic Party in labor-specific policies represented a lot more of the electorate. I think the party is, in this state, the base is splintering, and I think it's a real problem for the future of the party. And I'm a huge fan. I don't care who wins any election, but I'm a huge fan of really durable, competitive races. And we're not seeing that at the state level in Michigan if these results turn out the way they're trending tonight.
Got another question? Got someone right there.
As a member of the millennial generation, I'd like to respond to John's question about leadership and perhaps how it differs from between generations. And I'll begin with just challenging the notion of the definition of leadership. And traditionally, in the past, we've had more of a unilateral approach to leadership, where there's, you know, one individual and then a group of followers that goes in that direction. I think that our generation has more of a collective approach to leadership. And, you know, I can give you 3 examples in 3 distinct areas that are really the pillars of society. You have, you know, business, politics, and at the local community level. So for business, you see things like new startups that blow up and really turn the markets on their head in terms of, you know, Airbnb and Uber, and saying, hey, we're going to have a really minimal framework and leverage our user base as, you know, really moving things in a certain direction commercially, which differs from having this kind of unilateral monolith of a corporation kind of running the agenda. That's something that's really been pioneered by our generation. politics. Similarly, you know, I'll use the energy issue. You know, we never had renewable energy or climate energy policy happening at the federal level, so we marshaled people at the state level to push renewable energy policies at the state level. Again, another collective action, which is different from, you know, trying to get it done with one person in Congress or one body in Congress. And then lastly, at the community level, you can take Detroit in our backyard as an example. You have the Dan Gilbert approach of, you know, buying all the buildings in Detroit, and he's doing great work. I'm not disparaging that. And then you compare that to what a lot of people of our generation are doing, are collecting, you know, a few hundred bucks from everybody and buying these houses and revitalizing entire communities and street by street.
And voter by district, which is led by millennials.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, that's just a few examples I have to characterize what I think is a more collective approach to leadership, and I'd be curious to think, you know, to hear what my peers on the panel think about that.
Thank you. leadership definitely has a lot of different forms, and I think there is kind of a shift in sort of societal frameworks and how things are being moved and getting done these days. So that, I think that makes sense.
And I think that kind of speaks to your earlier point about how there's like a large chunk of liberal millennials and also a large chunk of libertarian millennials. And I think that this idea that we want to do things ourselves kind of speaks to what you were just saying. I do still think that there's a need for political leadership outside of, like, your community work. And, you know, we are one of the largest volunteer generations that we've had in the last several decades in terms of, like, percent of time spent volunteering. But I still think that there hopefully will be a movement towards political leadership as well.
Very good. Well, we're going to wrap this up with another trivia question. Ooh. So someone gets a chance to win and issues an ale pint glass. So your political question, and just raise your hand, and we've got the microphone handy. Let's see if we have this. What is the total number of electoral votes in the Electoral College? What did I hear? Raise your hand. I heard it back there. I know that. Right here? Okay. Right in front of you here. Yeah. 538. We have any more glasses? One more? All right. Let us have this one. Aaron, raise your hand. How many governors has Michigan had?
One.
Total number of governors that Michigan has had, including our current governor. Yeah, no fair Googling. In the state history. Ooh, did we get everybody? We stumped everybody?
Oh, wait, someone said it back here. Was it you? Yeah.
I think I heard it. Yeah.
Do I get to ask a question now?
You can. Yeah, you want to ask a question before we wrap?
Yeah, who is our greatest governor? I'll answer that myself. Hazen Pingree.
Potato Patch Pingree.
By the way, Hazen
Pingree wrote 90 plus pages every time he did the State of the State. He wrote a whole book on Detroit politics, which is absolutely awesome.
And Hazen Pingree, actually, Mike Duggan's hero is Hazen Pingree.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
He is a big Hazen Pingree junkie. There's a statue of Hazen Pingree in Grand Circus Park as a defender of the people, taking on the big corporations of the a century ago.
Yeah, I watched one of the Occupy Detroit kids get a ticket for putting a solidarity banner on. I have a question, though. It seems like we can't talk about the past anymore, you know, the education funding and all that stuff. We just apparently reelected a governor for 9,883,640-some-odd people. What five things has he said he would do in a second term that has not already been announced? Okay, we have the MAT2 program, which actually started in Washtenaw County. We have kids going to community college and the technical training, two different things. We have the roads, but we just reelected a governor of the state of Michigan for nearly 10 million people. And he has made absolutely no statement of what he will do.
And just as a note, Channel 7, you said, John, has called it now for Governor Snyder as well, so that's two media organizations. You know, I think that part, and I think part of what we have to do, like John said, is wait until tomorrow and see who voted which way, you know, to kind of try to figure out what people were responding to. We don't, you know, that's that, we won't really know more details.
He hasn't named them. No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, sir. Nothing in this campaign was about the next 4 years. I was on your guys talking about this. Both candidates defined this race as about the last four years, which I thought was a travesty. We don't know. It's a bit of a mystery how this is going to go.
And with that, we're going to wrap it up, and we want to thank John Bebo, who is the wonderful president and CEO of the Center for Michigan, Jan White, Michigan Radio's All Things Considered host, whose little doggies are saying, Mama, get home. We want you. We want you. We also want to thank very much Lauren Burdett and Ruth McDonald, our Ford School Master of Public Policy students. You guys were great. And thanks to all of you for being with us. And we are certainly urging you to hang around, and the TVs will be on. Buy some more beer and watch as things come in. Thank you so much for joining us.